From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a West Michigan university fires a professor for performing an LGBTQ wedding, sparking a legal case with potential to affect many other schools.
It never occurred to me that this would be the end with me and Calvin.
We'll hear about the circumstances and what precedent the case could establish.
If it rejects them, if it decides in favor of Kyelma, there is a chance that eventually the Supreme Court will need to more explicitly take on this issue.
Also today, the mail service that's kept ships on the Great Lakes connected for 100 years.
The way he got them on board these boats was very simply the technological advancement that is a bucket tied to a rope.
Those stories and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, Mail in a Pail, the company that spent a century getting packages, food deliveries, and more to sailors on Great Lakes ships.
What Westcott provides, they're sort of colloquially known as the mail boat, and that is one of their main functions, and it has been for a long time, but they do a lot of different things.
That's ahead today, but first, the Michigan Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments in a lawsuit over the firing of a former Calvin University professor who officiated an LGBTQ plus wedding. The case centers on a tenured social work professor who spent 14 years teaching at Calvin before his contract was terminated in 2022, after he officiated the wedding of two LGBTQ plus students. Calvin is a private Christian college that believes marriage is between a man and a woman, and it asks its employees to uphold these beliefs. Joseph Kyelma has sued Calvin, claiming that the university violated the state's Civil Rights Act when he was terminated. Today, we've invited Joseph Kyelma and his attorney, Teresa Huang, to talk to us about where the case stands now. Joseph, Teresa, welcome.
Thank you, April. It's great to be here.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Joe, when you agreed to preside at this wedding, did it enter your mind that it might put your job at risk?
So, April, honestly, it never occurred to me that this would be the end with me and Calvin. A former student of mine, Cole Sweeta, asked me to officiate his wedding to his lovely wife. And I thought, great. This is fantastic. Let's do it. I was in the middle of teaching a full load of classes. I had just had twins born during a pandemic who were premature. I was barely sleeping. I talked to some people in my department and I talked to some people at my personal church. And I said, does this seem in bounds to you? And they all said yes. And so I went ahead with it and there were no concerns at the time. But later, somebody forwarded photos of me officiating the ceremony to the administrators at Calvin, and I got called in, and they said, is this you in these photos? And I said, yeah, it sure looks like me. And we had a conversation, and it became clear that this was a deal breaker for them.
It's very common these days for people to become licensed online to perform a ceremony
right.
for friends. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, so I would describe myself as an officiant in this role. I had gone through some online certifications in order to do this wedding, but this was not a religious wedding, which also made it surprising that Calvin would have an issue with it. This was a wedding between two atheists. There was no mention of God in the ceremony, although there were plenty of mentions of love. So I was an officiant in a wedding between two people.
At the time when this happened, was there anything on the books at Calvin that indicated that there might be some kind of policy?
Right. So this is an open set of questions. Calvin has a relationship with the Christian Reformed Church, which is this denomination that folks in West Michigan are familiar with. And the Christian Reformed Church, since the 1970s, had what they called pastoral advice on working with same-sex attracted people. And, that was a fairly traditional position, but it was also a position that myself and a lot of my colleagues at Calvin disagreed with and felt free to disagree with because it was pastoral. Later, right. Actually, after I was terminated from Calvin in 2023, the denomination elevated that pastoral advice to something they called confessional and said, hey, if you're going to be a member of our denomination, you have to believe this. But that happened later. So there was a lot of surprise, I think, from myself and from my friends and colleagues that the Calvin administration was taking a harder stance on this than the denomination itself had taken.
Teresa Huang, let's turn to you. This has been a 3-year legal battle. What question are you and Joe asking the Michigan Supreme Court to decide for this case?
So we presented our application for leave to the Michigan Supreme Court. The court, upon reviewing the initial briefs, sent us an order that said that the court is interested in exploring and hearing about the question of whether there is sex-based associational discrimination, whether that is a claim under the Elliott-Larsen Civil Rights Act, and if so, whether Joe has pled that claim in this case. And so those are the two questions that the court will be interested in hearing in our oral arguments, which we expect to happen probably later this year.
Right. Joe, how did Calvin explain its decision to terminate your contract at the time you were fired?
So the line from Calvin was that I should have consulted with the provost and president directly before agreeing to do this because it was something that was going to be controversial. Again, I hadn't anticipated it being controversial. I hadn't shared any photos of it. I wasn't using it as a tool for advocacy, as some people have claimed. This was just something I was doing in my personal life for my friends. So they said that. And then the other complicating factor is that one of the individuals who got married was on staff at an institute that was part of Calvin. And so they said that I had effectively helped this other person break Calvin rules, rules that exist against, to be clear, they exist against same-sex sex, not as necessarily about marriage or civil marriage, but they did have rules about that. So they said, you basically helped this other person engage in sex that we think is wrong, and therefore you need to go.
Joe, have there been any repercussions for anybody else who was involved in the ceremony?
So Cole Sweda, who's still remains a close friend of mine, remains happily married. Cole was working for what was called the Center for Social Research at Calvin at the time, and that entire unit split off from Calvin University as a result of this controversy. And I think the leadership of that unit actually did that in part to protect Cole's position. They valued him as an employee and wanted to see him continue to work with them. And it had become clear that this no longer could happen underneath the umbrella of Calvin University. So we have to have a societal conversation about whether religion is a blank check to discriminate. If my school had decided, for example, that women should submit to men and that therefore women should not vote independently, that's a real position some Christians take, would we allow a Christian college to fire a woman for exercising her right to vote? I helped two individuals access their basic civil rights as Americans to marry one another, and I don't think that we should give religion a blank check to discriminate.
Teresa, Calvin has argued that it is protected as a private Christian university by our constitutional principles for religious freedom. And there's a fair amount of case law of institutions using these principles to talk about their hiring and firing decisions. Where do you believe that argument runs into limits under Michigan law?
Well, we've covered this extensively in our briefing to the Supreme Court, so I don't want to reiterate all of our arguments here, but there are two main arguments. One is that Joe is not covered under what's called the ministerial exception, and that is not a question that the Supreme Court is hearing. In fact, that's not a question that Calvin appealed from the trial court. Secondly, one of the arguments that Calvin has made to the Supreme Court is that they are covered under an ecclesiastical abstention doctrine, which would allow them to essentially make any decisions, any employment decisions that they want to, because they are a religious institution. However, we have argued that under the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine, and there's plenty of case law to support this, the question that the court needs to deliberate on is whether this case requires the court to determine any ecclesiastical, any religious doctrine question. And Joe and I firmly believe that this case does not require the court to determine any questions of religious doctrine.
Joe, can you maybe say, maybe tell us a little bit in closing about what your life has been like since Calvin forcibly separated the relationship? I understand you're teaching at Grand Valley State these days.
Yeah. So after I left Calvin, I thought my career in higher education might actually be coming to a close. My family, my wife and I are pretty committed to Grand Rapids. We didn't want to leave to go on the job market. But fortunately, some of the folks at Grand Valley reached out and said, hey, we saw your case. We like what you're doing. Are you looking for work? And I said, yeah, I am. So I took a visiting professor job at Grand Valley the fall after I was let go from Calvin and, you know, taught an overload of intro courses and other things. But the following year, I was lucky enough to obtain a tenure track position with them. And I'm hoping that I'll get to stick around and continue to teach social work education at Grand Valley, where it's been a really great fit for me. I've appreciated my colleagues there a lot.
Joseph Kailama teaches at Grand Valley State. As you've heard, he is formerly a professor at Calvin University. And we've been speaking also with his attorney, Teresa Huang. Teresa, Joe, thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for a break now. When we return, we'll hear from a reporter who's been covering this case and what she's learned from the college's perspective.
The Michigan state law, the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act that the professor is suing under, has very broad protections from discrimination. And it actually, in some cases, has been interpreted to protect from discrimination by association.
You're with Stateside. Stay with us. What's on your mind these days? We do love hearing from you, especially if there's a story or question we might be able to tackle. Anything specific to elections that you're curious about? What's the Michigan road trip you're most looking forward to taking this year? You can drop an email. The address is stateside@michiganpublic.org. Or maybe you'd rather leave a message on social media for us. We'll see it if you post on the Michigan Public Facebook page. Or you can also DM us on Instagram or TikTok. Our handles on both of those platforms are at Michigan Public. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Michigan Supreme Court is agreeing to hear the case of a former professor at Calvin University who's suing the institution over claims that the school broke state law based on gender or sexual identity. Joseph Kailama was terminated in 2022 after he officiated the LGBTQ+ wedding of some former students. Calvin is a private Christian college that believes marriage is between a man and a woman, and it asks employees to uphold these beliefs. Elizabeth Black is a breaking news reporter for the Christian news organization World, and she's been covering the case in her reporting. We've invited her to share some insights on the case. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
So for folks who don't follow church state law very closely, can you talk to us about what makes the Kailama case different from past disputes that might have involved religious schools and employment decisions?
For sure. So there's a couple things at play here. In general, the Supreme Court has fairly strongly ruled in favor of the ministerial exception, you know, the idea that religious institutions have different standards for who they can hire, and it does not fall under employment discrimination if they choose to hire people that align with their beliefs and not hire or terminate people who don't align with those beliefs. So generally, the Supreme Court has laid down pretty clear precedent in favor of the ministerial exception in most cases. However, in this case, there's a little bit more of a gray area, and there's actually an opportunity for new precedent to be set, because we're dealing with a much more expanded state anti-discrimination law than in some cases. The Michigan state law, the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act that the professor is suing under, has very broad protections from discrimination, and it actually, in some cases, has been interpreted to protect from discrimination by association. So that's what he's arguing. His argument that the Michigan Supreme Court is going to hear is that the school discriminated against him by terminating his contract because of his association with people of a sexual and gender identity that the school did not sanction. So that's a very broad claim that the Supreme Court has not addressed yet. And that's because some of those state laws, again, just cover more categories of discrimination than the court has laid down an opinion on so far.
I was trying to figure out if this case is more about religious freedom protections or more about how Michigan civil rights law is written and applied. But I guess that's sort of what the court is being asked to determine, right?
It is, yes. So when we're looking to see how the Supreme Court might decide, the Michigan Supreme Court, there is precedent from U.S. circuit courts around the country, different federal courts, that they may look at, but they don't have to. It's not binding on them. So while they will be looking at those previous ministerial exception cases that the Supreme Court laid down, there's other discrimination cases that have been decided in those federal circuit courts that could be guidance, but also they don't have to follow those decisions. So two that I'm thinking about for comparison here. One was the 1983 case of Bob Jones versus United States, which was decided in the Fourth Circuit, I believe. Essentially, the court decided that the school was, they were invoking God to justify discrimination on the basis of race. That's what the court decided. And they said, not all burdens on religion are unconstitutional. They said, you know, in this case, we think the school is, you know, performing race-based discrimination. And so it's not, you know, unlawfully burdening their exercise of faith to tell them to admit people of, you know, various racial characteristics that were not previously admitted. Another case, though, that could have some bearing on Kailama's case just came down in January in the Ninth Circuit Court. That's Union Gospel Mission versus Brown. And in that case is a homeless mission in Washington. They said that they want their employees to agree with their religious views on sex and gender. And this case was different because these workers were an IT guy and another type of worker that didn't clearly have a religious function. And in this case, the court said the ministerial exception still applies in this case because it's a religious organization that has this policy. And if the court interfered, it would be making an ecclesiastical decision. It would be interfering in faith in that case. Mm. And that's especially relevant to us because that case in Washington, the Union Gospel Mission case that I just talked about, that also involved an expanded anti-discrimination law, very similar to the Michigan law in the Kailama case.
Yeah. We understand that Calvin's position is that same-sex acts are sinful. And you've reported that the denomination of the school is also about inclusion of LGBTQ plus people, meaning to say, you know, they do not agree with you know, people living that life, but at the same time, they want to present a welcoming overture to people in LGBTQ communities. And I believe that allows them to serve in the offices and in the life of churches and church congregations, right?
It does, yes. Yeah, the Christian Reformed Church's position is that people who experience same-sex attraction are treated just as any other member of the church. And like you said, they're allowed to serve in the church and be part of the life of the church in just the same way. But yes, they do draw a line there. They say in their confessional statements that people may bear a responsibility for their attraction, but they feel like that's a gray area. So like I said, yeah, they allow people with same-sex attraction to participate in everything the same. But then, yes, they do say homosexual unions, homosexual relationships are outside those boundaries.
Elizabeth, do you think that this is indicative of the unresolved nature of the way that organizations that are based in faith, how they're trying to reconcile an evolving piece of doctrine and policy?
Yes, I think this case definitely illustrates that there's a huge gray area there in how people approach that issue, especially people of faith. And it's especially clearly demonstrated here because the denomination and later the college both clarified their stances on homosexuality and made them stronger, kind of to the point that we've just discussed, because I think they, you know, they came to a crossroads where they said we have to make a decision one way or another what, you know, route we want our pastors, our teachers, and so forth to follow. But that gray area has become more clear because of cases like this, where there's, the professor would argue that there was confusion there, you know, that it was not clear to him that officiating this wedding was, you know, outside of the professional conduct that the school expected and so forth. So I think there's a good many organizations, you know, and denominations working through this. But I think in the last few years, the need for clear positions and regulations and so forth has become really apparent to a lot of them because of cases like this, because there is this litigation.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, do you think that this kind of showdown was destined to happen in a sense?
I think so, especially at Calvin. According to just research that I've done on the background of the school and so forth, you know, there was some understanding that, you know, while the denomination had its official position, there was room for disagreement. Even the college has, since Kailama's firing, the college has allowed some faculty to submit statements of disagreement over issues of homosexuality and to file those with the school. And the school did vote to keep those faculty. I don't want to get too into the weeds there because I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but they've allowed some measure of disagreement, but they've drawn the line on kind of conduct that clearly displays that disagreement. So there's still, as far as I know, some kind of, you know, unresolvedness about this situation.
Joseph Kailama has argued that the school did, you mentioned this, that the school did not have a policy in place and that he felt that it was, you know, that this was not going to be an action that violated the terms of his employment when he officiated the wedding. From your reporting, the university has clarified its policies. Do you think that's going to make a difference to the court?
So, yes, I believe the school is arguing that, you know, the Christian Reformed Church, which they are affiliated with, has held that homosexual activity outside of marriage is sinful since the 70s. So the school would say, sure, you know, that position has been strengthened and clarified since, but, you know, by officiating this wedding, he's endorsing that behavior that the denomination condemns. So that's what the school would say in this case. I think it would argue that standards were sufficiently clear. But like you said, Kailama, I think, would argue the opposite. He has said that there was not anything in the time, in the faculty handbook, for instance, that clearly laid out kind of that boundary that the college has talked about between room for personal disagreement and professional conduct. And the school has really hammered that conduct line, that they want their professors to teach and act in ways that align with their beliefs, even if they personally disagree. So I think that's a hairy issue for the court to decide, but I think that fine line will be possibly, was it obvious enough to Kailama based on the school's, you know, position statements and affiliation with the denomination, where that line should have been drawn about professional conduct.
What will you be watching for as the case moves forward, both legally and culturally at Calvin?
One big thing would be just to see if the Supreme Court in its decision or in oral arguments refers to those other court cases that I mentioned earlier, especially the January case, Union Gospel Mission versus Brown, that was decided in the Ninth Circuit. In that case, you know, a faith-based ministry won, arguing that their employees had to be aligned with their beliefs and making employment decisions on that basis. So while those other courts' rulings are not controlling in this case, they don't have to follow them. The Ninth Circuit especially has recently been making a lot of decisions kind of in favor of the faith-based ministries side of the argument. So whether the court in this case follows those as precedent or rejects them will be very significant. If it rejects them, if it decides in favor of Kailama, there is a chance that, you know, eventually the Supreme Court will need to more explicitly take on this issue and address whether associational discrimination claims cover situations like this, because, you know, split precedent at lower levels is what generally tees up the Supreme Court's decision to, you know, take on one of these huge and controversial cases.
Elizabeth Black is the breaking news reporter for the Christian news organization World, which produces daily coverage of global, national, and cultural events through a biblical lens. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks again for having me. I really appreciate it.
We reached out to Calvin University, and they sent us a statement that says the university stands with the Christian Reformed Church denominations and states that, quoting here, while there's room for personal disagreement with CRC doctrine, the university has clear expectations for employees regarding teaching, scholarship, and personal conduct, and follows established processes to review alleged violations of those expectations and determine appropriate responses. In other stories we're following, a Charlevoix man who died on the battlefield in eastern Ukraine was finally laid to rest last week. John James Witherspoon was 28 years old. He was a member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. Interlochen Public Radio's Austin Rowlater went to Charlevoix Township Hall, where Witherspoon lay in state for 48 hours. Austin spoke with some of Witherspoon's family and friends.
John James Witherspoon was fighting for Ukrainian sovereignty against Russia. He died in action in eastern Ukraine on January 17, 2025. That same day, 4,700 miles away in Charlevoix, his mother, Sandra Witherspoon, felt something wasn't quite right.
You know, I don't normally get anxiety attacks, but the morning he was killed, I woke up with this anxiety attack, and I'm thinking, what's going on, you know, what?
It wasn't until a week later that his family found out that he'd been killed. Russian forces captured and held his body. But now, over a year later, he returns home.
He lived to the hilt, enjoyed life, had a lot of fun. But I couldn't, you know, talk him out of his desire to go into the military. It was like, and then he signed up with the International Legion. But he initially told me he was going to be a welder over there to weld, and he would be in the green zone. He just told me that so I wouldn't worry. But once he was there, it was obvious that he was in the military.
According to family and friends, Witherspoon was a talented and joyful man. He played guitar and saxophone, and he graduated from Interlochen Arts Academy. After graduation, he traveled the country, he picked up welding, but still, he felt his true calling was the battlefield.
In our culture, it's a huge honor to be a warrior and a veteran. And so that, ever since he was a young boy, that was something he always wanted to do. So there was really no talking him out of it.
Witherspoon was Native American, a member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. According to his obituary, he decided to go to Ukraine to, quote, defend the freedom, sovereignty, and ancestral lands of innocent people.
For the, you know, their history with the, and ours parallel. You know, here in our land, we lost, you know, our land and our sovereignty mean the world to us. And he went there to help them defend their sovereignty and their land. So that's who he was. He was always for the underdog.
Witherspoon's father, also John Witherspoon, led a ceremony at the foot of his son's casket. He spoke of his son's curiosity and his philosophical nature.
He felt in his heart and in his spirit that if he could use that to help others, he's going to do it.
Witherspoon says his son was a force for good, fighting to defend the most basic human rights of sovereignty, peace, and freedom.
One of the things that John wanted most in his life was to understand and begin to repair the damage done to love, the damage done to kindness, the damage done in keeping the races apart. He wanted to fix it.
A few miles away, at the Bridge Street Tap Room in Charlevoix, sits Gary Grapp. He just came from the township hall where he paid his last respects.
He wanted to know where me and John used to sit, and I said, well, if I wasn't here, John would sit right here.
He and Witherspoon used to play guitar together, and they often sat here together at the bar. He remembers when he found out Witherspoon had died in battle.
Realized I wouldn't play guitar with him again for many, many years until I see him again on the other side. And I came right down here and I sat in my chair. I thought about all the times that him and I'd sat here, talking about everything under the sun, fishing, guitars, the lake, the weather, everything. Yeah, he was a great friend.
That was reporter Austin Rowlater from Interlochen Public Radio. It's time for us to take a break. When we come back, we'll review how to get takeout on your next Great Lakes shipping assignment.
Captain Westcott maintained a mindset that his work was so critical to the work of these other mariners that they needed to perform their job.
That's in just a moment. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Detroit is home to a unique business that's been operating for more than 150 years. The J.W. Westcott Company makes regular trips between the Port of Detroit and the Great Lakes freighters that pass through. An exhibition at the Dawson Great Lakes Museum on Belle Isle shows how this company's founder, J.W. Westcott, met the needs of sailors and companies carrying goods across the lakes. As communication evolved and radically changed, the company continues to adapt both to more modern needs and more modern technology. We've invited Bill Pringle to tell us more. He's the curator for the exhibit at the Dawson Great Lakes Museum. Bill Pringle, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thanks so much, April. I'm more than happy to be here.
I guess my favorite thing about what you've worked on is the name of this exhibit, Mail in a Pail. Can you explain the haphazard way that the Westcott Company got started?
Sure. Yeah, Mail by the Pail. I wish I could take credit for that one. That is a phrase that became synonymous with this business for a very long time. But I mean, really, the name is on the tin. So way back in this company's roots, the deliveries that Captain J.W. Westcott was making to the ships going up and down the Detroit River, the way he got them on board these boats was very simply the technological advancement that is a bucket tied to a rope. When these boats saw Captain Westcott come up alongside and tie up, they would drop down a bucket and they would haul up anything that Captain Westcott had for them. And they'd also use that same bucket to drop down anything they might have had for him, outgoing mail reports and that sort of thing. So this was a system that was used for many, many years, kind of bearing the lead here. They still do that today. On the big giant freighters that go up and down the Detroit River, they still use the rudimentary technology of a bucket tied to a rope that was first used in 1874 when Westcott started his business.
Oh, man. I mean, I gather that back when Westcott was getting his business underway, were there many other options for ship-to-shore communications even?
Other than just simply yelling, no. You know, you can get a message across by just shouting to and from a ship back then. Because when this started, most of the traffic on the lakes was, you know, sail-driven vessels, schooners, and that sort of thing. But really, to get a message on board or off of a boat, you had to stop and get off and deliver your message, which is what really brought about Captain Westcott's business in the first place.
There was a time when Great Lakes shipping was a very primary form of transportation in the business of the United States. Can you talk a little bit about how the Westcott Company grew over time?
Kent Muescat grew up on the lakes. His family is very well connected to the Great Lakes maritime interests. He becomes the youngest captain on the Great Lakes, supposedly, at the age of 20.
Wow.
Yes, very young. And becomes the master of several ships early in his career and early in his life. And he gains this practical experience taking ships up and down the Great Lakes and spending some time on Lake Superior. He learns the ins and outs and a lot of the headaches involved with piloting, in his case, steamships on the Great Lakes. And so there comes a time when he decides to put one of his ideas into practice, and that's taking orders to ships as they're moving up and down the river. And the reason why this is such an innovation is because these boats that were leaving the upper Great Lakes with their cargoes, you know, be it iron or wheat or lumber, when they were coming to the southern lakes, you know, they knew generally they were probably going to Lake Erie, but they didn't know exactly where they were going. You know, maybe they had a rough idea of Cleveland, but they could get there, and any number of problems could have made it so that there could be a backup there. You know, maybe rough weather held up certain shipments. Maybe equipment broke down that it's used to get the cargoes off these ships. Any number of things could have happened that could have caused delays for these ships and the shipping companies. And, you know, that really hampered how quickly they're able to do business. And so the way they got around this was by keeping an eye on these ports on Lake Erie, for example, and sending a telegram to Detroit, which is the last major port before you hit Lake Erie and the ports down there. And these boats would stop in Detroit, you know, anchor and send someone on shore to get the orders from the telegraph office. And obviously, this was a pretty colossal break in their timeline. It was a headache for the crew. You know, taking that much extra time meant, you know, taking that much time meant fewer trips they were able to take throughout the season.
Yeah, time was absolutely money in shipping.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because the shipping season on the Great Lakes, you know, you're losing some of that time due to winter and the lakes freezing over. So these companies are absolutely going to try and squeeze out as many runs as they can up and down the lakes. So any amount of time they can save is absolutely precious. And so Captain Westcott gets this idea, well, maybe I can eliminate the need for these ships to stop altogether. So he partners with these shipping companies to gather the orders for where they're going to be docking ahead of time. And he rows out into the middle of the river where these giant steamships are passing up and down. He throws them a rope. They tie it on, and his little rowboat gets jerked up out of the water, and he tries to stay in the boat. And they lower down a pail, and he tells them where they're going to be going.
Okay, wait a second, Bill. I guess when I heard about this company that was, you know, so important to, maritime history, I guess I envisioned like a fleet of Westcott ships that were out there doing this work. You're saying the whole time it was just one guy in a rowboat?
For a very long time it was. Yeah, in those early days, it was Captain Westcott by himself 24/7. Because river traffic was day and night. So he basically only got time to rest at the dock in the rowboat where he napped in between needing to go out to take out orders to these boats.
Wow. Well, I guess being a one-man operation, that gives you a better opportunity for a profit margin, if nothing else.
Absolutely. He did expand over time, and he hired on like-minded individuals who were very adept at piloting these rowboats. So one of his marine reporters by the name of George Abrams, he worked for many years with the company. He didn't know how to swim. And yet he was going out into the middle of river traffic, swerving past boats going every which way, without ever falling out of the little rowboat. In fact, saving lives in the process, too, of folks who may have fallen into the river. So this was a job that was performed by some very skilled individuals, very handy with oars in their hands.
It sounds like this could have been a very dangerous line of work. I mean, anybody who knows anything about shipping history knows that we've got our share of wrecks. The lakes can get pretty gnarly in the weather. How did that affect how Captain Westcott went about his business?
So I think maybe Captain Westcott's understanding of bad weather might have been a little bit more than what we think of today. I read at least one account of the rowboats being kept at the dock because of severe weather. But for the most part, Captain Westcott maintained a mindset that his work was so critical to the work of these other mariners that they needed to perform their job. Of course, if it was super dangerous, they weren't going to put their lives in danger. In fact, the company went many, many, many years without any sort of fatality. The company did, unfortunately, lose two lives, but that wasn't until 2001. So for many years, the company performed without any significant loss of life for their crew, which I think is just incredible.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Has the technology changed in the kinds of services that Westcott provides?
Yes. So what Westcott provides, they're sort of colloquially known as the mailboat. And that is one of their main functions, and it has been for a long time. But they do a lot of different things. So they do deliver mail to the freighters going up and down the Detroit River. And believe it or not, they only gained that mail contract starting in the 40s. So there was a period of time where the U.S. government, the Postal Service, ran a mailboat on the Detroit River as well. But ever since 1948, the Westcott has been delivering mail. They also serve the critical function of delivering pilots to some of the boats coming up and down the river. With the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway in the 50s, that connected the Great Lakes to the wider world. International ships were able to enter the Great Lakes. And with that came the requirement that any international vessel coming into these waters needed to have a North American pilot on board, someone who is familiar with the waters of the Great Lakes in order to guide them through. The Westcott Company is one of the organizations that brings these pilots to these boats. They get them on board sometimes using a ladder or, climbing up the side of the boats, very literally. And so that's one of the very important roles they fulfill, given, the commerce of the Great Lakes and North America and, frankly, the world broadly.
Something of a business-to-business taxi service then.
Yeah, precisely.
Are there newer services that the Westcott Company has started providing today? I mean, obviously, a lot of the communications processes have changed a great deal. I mean, people can just pick up the cell phone if they want to get orders from HQ.
Oh, absolutely. It's wild when you stop and think about the vast technological differences that have happened between 1874, when this company started, and today. We're talking before even radio. So in the time between now and then, we eventually get radio, we get ship-to-shore communication. Fast forward to today, where we have smartphones in our pocket, which connect us to the entire world. I can talk to someone, on literally the other side of the world, no problem. And, that in one way eliminates the need for a lot of mail that might be delivered to these boats. And so that provides a hurdle. But also, we have less river traffic as well. Bigger ships means fewer ships. One boat might be able to do the work of two or more. And that, of course, means a smaller crew as well to deliver mail to. So there have been lots of technological changes that have meant the way that Westcott does business needs to change a little bit. I think one of the biggest ways that we receive packages these days is through Amazon, obviously. you know, Amazon, I suppose, depending on where you are, they do their own deliveries. They don't rely on the Postal Service. So that's not something that Westcott would typically get in the mailbag, so to speak. But they do deliver many, many Amazon packages to these boats. and, you know, especially we having gone through, you know, things like COVID, that was a time when everybody was ordering stuff nonstop. And I feel like that hasn't slowed down any. So they become a transporter for that final leg of the journey of things like Amazon packages, but also new things like, you know, DoorDash. They advertise, hey, if your ship is passing by Detroit and you really want a Detroit-style pizza or Coney dogs, we'll go get it for you. We'll bring it out to your boat. And they do. But also, you know, grocery deliveries too and that sort of thing.
I can easily imagine that this is not a small matter of concern to a lot of mariners.
No.
What kinds of things can folks expect from the exhibition?
Sure. Well, you're going to be able to explore the whole timeline of the business's history, you know, starting with the early days of Captain J.W. Westcott, you know, him becoming a captain and gaining experience. And a lot of that early history does have to do with him himself, because he was such a beloved individual in Detroit and the broader maritime community. He had his fingers in a lot of different businesses. But so much of it was synonymous with the maritime world. And he was so conspicuous in Detroit that he sort of became the face of the maritime world in the city. Folks who didn't even really have anything to do with that business would know Captain Westcott and say, you know, that's the guy who knows about, you know, river traffic, about boats. If there's something they need to know, they would go to Captain Westcott, because he was involved in organizations that involved the owners of the boats to the crews of the boats. He knew basically everybody on those vessels that were moving up and down the river. He knew their owners. You know, he was in the same room with them and talked with them. His office became the hangout for a lot of the crews that worked on these boats. And so learning about those ways that he ingratiated himself to all these communities, I think, is a big part of the exhibit. He was also really a staunch advocate for safety. You know, he implemented navigational aids on the Detroit River. He was out there, he was funding daily depth soundings of certain areas of the Detroit River to make sure ships didn't run aground. And when they did run aground, conveniently, he had a wrecking company to help get these boats back afloat again. Between being a vessel agent and having a wrecking company and, you know, even at one point having a school for sailors in his office, he was the guy. So much so that when he passed away, it was ordered that all ships on the Great Lakes on the day of his funeral run their flags at half mast.
Wow.
So a lot of the story is about Captain Westcott, but the fact of the matter is the company is still a family-run business today, family-owned and operated. And I think that's a really powerful part of the story, too, that through all these changes in technology and changes in how they do their business, the family is still super committed to their role in maritime business and the community on the Detroit River and the Great Lakes more broadly. The people at Westcott truly love their jobs and really do, I think, have an appreciation for their place in the history of this region, really. And I think that's super cool.
Bill Pringle is the curator of Mail by the Pail, the J.W. Westcott Company, that is on view at the Dawson Great Lakes Museum on Belle Isle in Detroit. You can see the exhibition through August. Bill, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansug, Michelle Jokish-Polo, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Public. Find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.